Take 2001, the first film to link the camera and the computer in the creation of special effects for the spaceship's journey into the unknown. This was a breakthrough in technical wizardry. Every frame of 2001 made you aware that the possibilities for cinematic manipulations are indeed infinite. It was at once a superproduction, an experimental film, and a visionary poem. Considering the way the world was moving so quickly at the time, this just said, no, 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 I want you to see something. I'm going to take you through something you never thought you'd ever experience.
Okay, all flight controllers, go, no, go for landing. Retro.
Go.
Rhino.
Go.
Guide.
Go.
Control.
Go.
Telcom.
Go.
GNC.
Go.
Ecom.
Go.
Surgeon.
Go.
Capcom, we're go for landing.
Altitude 4200.
You think you're go for landing, over.
Roger, understand. Go for landing. 3,000 feet.
You're looking great.
How you doing, Control?
We look good here. Fine.
All right, how about you, Telcom?
Go.
Guidance, you happy?
Go.
Fido.
Go.
2,000 feet. 2,000 feet. Into the ag. 47 degrees.
Roger.
47 degrees.
It's still looking very good.
Here go.
Shot alarm.
1201.
Roger,
1201 alarm. 1201
alarm.
Same type,
we're go flight.
Okay,
we're go.
We're go, same type, we're go.
Altitude 1600.
Eagle looking great. Roger, 1202, we copy it. 35 degrees, 750, coming down to 23. 540 feet, down to 15. 1050 feet, down at 4. Altitude, velocity, light. 3.5 down, 220 feet. 11 forward, coming down nicely, 200 feet. 4.5 down, 5.5 down. 100 feet, 3.5 down, 9 forward. 875 feet, guys looking good, down a half. 6 forward.
60 seconds.
Lights on, forward. Forward, 40 feet down, 2.5. Picking up some dust. Great shadow. Four forward, drifting to the right a little.
30 seconds.
Forward. Contact light. Okay, engine stop.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Drifting, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
Hello, fellow space travelers. This is Brett. And, you know, if you've been listening to this show for a while, you might have seen the title and heard that intro, and you might be asking something like, who are you? Where are you taking me? And if I've played my cards correctly, you should be somewhat confused as to the direction of this show. Believe me, when we started planning for this in the middle of last week, I was very uncertain and confused about the direction of this show. But we're just going to let it unfold, if you don't mind. This is a story that started for me really in 2011 when I was working with a 9-year-old boy who was all into aliens and monsters, and one of the things that he was interested in investigating was the moon landing hoax. And at first I said, haha, that's one of the silliest conspiracy theories. But weeks later, I'll tell ya, I was very intrigued by this story, and my interest in this topic was reinvigorated at the beginning of last week when a caller to Free Talk Live named Sam Dodson, who actually used to be up here in New Hampshire as part of the Free State Project, somebody that I have a lot of respect for, a very talented filmmaker, videographer, and a super nice guy, called into the show to talk about a conspiracy documentary that sounded too good to be true.
On Free Talk Live. Hey, Sam.
Hey, gentlemen.
Hey, and so, there's a lady here.
Hey, Sam.
I'm calling because last Friday, at the end of the call, I mentioned that the Apollo mission might have been faked, and Mark, that conspiracy phobic host of yours, laughed at me. And so I wanted to explain some.
I think we both laughed at that one.
Well, I don't think Mark was there, though. No. There's Stanley Kubrick is who we were actually talking about. And I referenced a very special camera lens that he was given by NASA. There was a French documentary crew that interviewed his wife after he passed away, and she pulled the spec sheets and a thank you letter out of the safe, out of his safe, and showed it to the camera crew that was there interviewing, and suggested that that was kind of a really firm piece of evidence. Why would NASA give this multi-million dollar satellite lens to some unknown film director that they have no relationship with? But the real crux of the whole moon landing hoax around Apollo 11 is encoded in the movie The Shining. Is that something you guys have seen?
I've seen it. It's okay. It's Stephen King novel,
Stephen
right?
King book, correct.
Right. So it's got Jack Nicholson in it.
Here's Johnny.
Yep, he goes up with his family to. He's going to be the caretaker of this hotel up in the wherever it was.
Somehow goes crazy or gets possessed or something.
Yeah, and then attempts to murder his family.
That's right. And actually, some of the Stephen King fans were really angry at Stanley Kubrick over that movie because he departed from the book in a number of significant and really also insignificant ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because what's encoded in the movie is really his confession of how and why he faked the Apollo 11 moon landing for NASA.
Now, I have to say, this is
Stanley
interesting.
Did Stanley Kubrick say this?
No,
it's a theory.
Okay.
I
just want to make sure.
But this is a new theory, though. I never heard this version. I mean, because I've seen the claims about the moon landing being faked. I've also seen the counterclaims that debunk the claims that the moon landing was fake, and those are also very interesting. But this is the first time I've heard this one, so go ahead.
And I'm not saying that NASA and the U.S. government has not been to the moon. I think, you know, I've watched Mythbusters where they did the moon landing and all that, and they show some really compelling evidence, like the reflector that's sending back the laser from the moon and giving you speed of light measurements and so forth. So I think absolutely governments have been to the moon. I'm saying that maybe what they did after the Gemini missions where they burned astronauts alive and had all these failures was that maybe they didn't want to put that live on primetime TV so that, A, the American people wouldn't see it if something were to go wrong, but also so that, you know, the Russians who we were engaged in this Cold War with, the government was engaged in the Cold War with, wouldn't see the kind of technology and advancements that were at the cutting edge of NASA's capability at the time.
I mean, so, it's plausible
to
suggest.
The suggestion is that the United States put astronauts on the moon, but all the information we have about the moon landings is faked, right?
Well, it's that, yes, that what was presented to the public was faked, was maybe done on a soundstage using backscreen projection, which is something that Stanley Kubrick was made famous for from his movie 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is, you know, highly acclaimed and was groundbreaking for its time and all of that. So it's that they went there, but maybe they didn't use the Saturn V rocket to go to the moon. And there's a great YouTube
It's possible,
video.
Right? Like, I mean, it's a plausible suggestion that the government would have set this up just to make it look like, you know, everything was peachy and that, you know, to essentially scam the American people wouldn't be the first time.
Those astronauts must have been petrified on this mission. I mean, either that or they're just people that look at situations with the kind of bravery that I don't understand.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that for a second. They must have been petrified on this mission to be in the dark void of space trying to land on another body, and then return.
But ultimately, Sam, I mean, this just kind of falls into the category of, oh, wouldn't that be interesting, right? Because it doesn't really have any bearing on what's going on today, right?
Well, no, I think it does, and that's, you know, I'll be calling in over the coming weeks and so forth and kind of building a bigger picture that I think will really reshape kind of what people accept as reality if you go and look into it. And this is just another one of those pieces. So the thing I would suggest for those that really find what I'm talking about interesting is to go to YouTube and watch The Shining Code. It's like an hour and a half sort of documentary that takes the symbolism and the embedded codes in The Shining and lays them out, shows you the background of what was going on and so forth. And then you can go and watch The Shining and see, you know, all of these things kind of unfold.
And so that was the very next thing that I did. I went home and I went to YouTube and I typed in Shining Code and I watched it and I was disappointed. And, you know, some of you, like I said at the very beginning, who've listened to the show for a while might be saying, Brett, this doesn't sound like you. This doesn't sound like the kind of thing that you do. Well, here's some of my interests, folks. filmmaking. Stanley Kubrick is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. He was a true auteur. He had more control over his projects than just about any filmmaker ever that I can think of, from the production to the editing to every part, every detail. And I think that's one of the things that makes the idea that he might have been embedding messages into the film, because things very, very rarely would happen by accident in a Stanley Kubrick film. And when you see Stanley Kubrick's movies, when you watch 2001 or A Clockwork Orange or now, The Shining, Eyes Wide Shut, you know there's other stuff going on. And Eyes Wide Shut was almost completely re-edited before its release, I think, without Stanley Kubrick's participation, because he died 4 or 5 days after he showed the film to the studio, and they were not really excited about the director's cut version of the film. And I'll tell you this, from even just a week of experience and maybe a little more than a decade of real admiration for the work of Stanley Kubrick, the more you look into this story, the more you will find. That is true with Kubrick and the messages of his films or the meanings of his films. There's a tremendous amount of writing and scholarship on the meaning of 2001: A Space Odyssey. Even as a separate issue, the Apollo missions. Right, it's real easy to walk into a minefield of rabbit holes on both of those investigations. And we're going to try to avoid most of that today. But you've been warned, right? If you start looking into this stuff, there's a real information overload or misinformation overload that you're going to have to deal with. So one interest, one reason why I was interested in pursuing this as a topic is Stanley Kubrick, one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. I'm also very interested in space. I'm interested in flight. This is, even as a hobby, this is something that is very alluring to me, this whole story, right? But if I'm going to invest all this time in this project, how can I make it useful to what we're doing on this show? So before we go any further, and what you're going to hear is the live show from the 15th. We had a lot of audience participation in this one. We had a caller named Nick from Australia who's actually studied the Apollo program in college. We had Alan Murdoch, one of the founders of the Skeptical Libertarian. And eventually we had Sam. Yes, that caller from Free Talk Live. And we kept him on the phone with us for quite a while. So that's all in the show today. But because this is such an interesting topic and there's so much exciting speculation, this show had the potential to turn into a real jack-off fest with, let's guess and maybe this happened and that, that kind of thing. And we shouldn't do that. So before we even get into the conversation, I want to lay down some themes that will recur in the show today. You'll hear these things mentioned throughout the show. But what's really grounding us in this critical thinking exercise about not just the Apollo hoax, so-called, but also conspiracy theories in general, is fallacies of omission. The fallacies in this group include the complex question or the loaded question, hypothesis contrary to fact, appeal to a lack of evidence, the argument from the negative, and of course, stacking the deck. So all omission fallacies occur because a person who's making a presentation leaves out necessary material, or, if it's a film, it's very easy to steer around or misdirect the audience from the fact that certain important information and understanding might be missing from the presentation. So most conspiracy presentations are often based on the complex question or the loaded question. So the example that we've all heard is, when did you stop beating your wife? So you're implying something in your question, right? You make it look like, oh, this is just a quest for information, but built into that question is actually an accusation. So the definition is phrasing a question or a statement in such a way as to imply another unproven statement is true without evidence or discussion. This fallacy often overlaps with begging the question, since it also presupposes a definite answer to a previous unstated question. Now, I guess in a conspiracy theory, the complex question would be, how have you been deceived? In other words, you have been deceived is something that is kind of taken for granted in this situation. The next fallacy that is made use of is stacking the deck. In this fallacy, and I'm reading these from the logical fallacies hand list, which is cn.edu. I'll put a link to the whole list, a very useful and well-organized list in the show notes for today's episode. So stacking the deck. In this fallacy, the speaker stacks the deck in his or her favor by ignoring examples that disprove the point and listing only those examples that support the case. This fallacy is closely related to hasty generalization, but the term usually implies deliberate deception rather than accidental logical error. So the opposite of stacking the deck, which is done in your favor, would be the straw man argument, where you weaken the other person's position by making it look foolish, like by amplifying or exaggerating or twisting all of the most implausible elements of whatever their argument is. And maybe through an irrelevant conclusion, right? So if somebody favors the Austrian school of economics, they would work their way kind of hastily through a worst case scenario and say, well, you know, people who are in favor of the Austrian school clearly want poor people to die. You see how the fallacies work together in that respect. Another very popular one in a lot of conspiracy presentations is the argument from the negative. Arguing from the negative asserts that since one position is untenable, the opposite must be true. And if you watch a lot of these moon landing hoax videos on YouTube, I mean, there are actually some pretty well-produced documentaries about the Apollo mission hoax. We had to, after the Shining Code turned out to be such an abysmal failure, even really for analysis on the show, we watched another one called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon. So the argument from the negative also incorporates the either-or fallacy, or the fallacy of the excluded middle that we've talked about several times on the show, where, look, it can only go this way or that way. They either went to the moon or they didn't. And as Sam hinted in his call, it's possible. It's plausible. Remember, plausibility is not provability. That's another thing that we're going to talk about on the show today. That it's more than just a binary choice here. Appeal to the lack of evidence is another one. Argumentum ad ignorantium, literally the argument from ignorance. Appealing to a lack of information to prove a point or arguing that since the opposition cannot disprove a claim, the opposite stance must be true. So the appeal to the lack of evidence and the argument from the negative are almost identical. I think one is deliberate and one, it's suggested, is more accidental. The hypothesis contrary to fact, argumentum ad speculum. Trying to prove something in the real world by using imaginary examples alone, or asserting that if hypothetically X had occurred, Y would have been the result. For example, suppose an individual asserts that if Einstein had been aborted in utero, the world would never have learned about relativity. Or if Monet had been trained as a butcher rather than going to college, the impressionistic movement would have never influenced modern art. Some hypotheses are misleading lines of argument because it is often possible that some other individual would have solved the relativistic equation or introduced an impressionistic art style. Now, remember at the American Way series in the opening, where we played a clip from a very progressive talk show called the David Pakman Show, where they're saying, well, if you shot Hitler when he was a baby, I think the quote is that would have put the kibosh on the whole thing. There never would have been a Holocaust. There never would have been a rise of the Third Reich. And what we tried to lay out in that series was how insignificant Hitler actually was, considering the momentum of the German culture through the end of the 1800s and into the 1900s. Hitler was a spark. Hitler was a match thrown at a gasoline-soaked house. So the speculation about if this didn't happen, then this would have happened, that breaks us away from reality. The hypothesis, contrary to fact, allows this breakaway from reality where all kinds of speculation can be introduced in a very convincing way if a person doesn't have their guard up when viewing some of these conspiracy documentaries. And once you enter that realm of speculation, the person who is guiding you down this conspiracy path can reinforce their position with more loaded questions. Right? Why did Kubrick do this? You know, it works. And it's very, very common in a lot of these documentaries. So that's the groundwork from the fallacy standpoint. But another thing that's very important in evaluating the validity of certain conspiracy theories is something called unfalsifiability. This was something that the philosopher Karl Popper introduced. And unfalsifiability is this great place that somebody who wants to propose a far-out theory can get to where there's no way to prove it false, right? And one of the problems with the Apollo hoax theories is that most people just do not have the scientific background knowledge to evaluate the NASA story versus the conspiracy theory story in a meaningful way that leads anywhere. So a good conspiracy theory will have this unfalsifiability, meaning that even when somebody says, all right, the evidence that you've provided doesn't really lead to your conclusion in an ironclad way, the conspiracy theorist could then change some of the rules. There's a podcast called The Critical Thinker, and he did a series of shows about conspiracy theories, and his example is a funny one, that a little green demon is inside his watch turning the minute hand and the hour hand. This could be falsified by opening the watch and looking for a little green demon. But then the conspiracy theorist, the person with the watch, can change the story to make the conspiracy unfalsifiable. I don't know if having a demon in your watch is really a conspiracy. Can make the claim, I should say, unfalsifiable by saying, oh, whenever you open the watch, the demon turns invisible, right? So then it's back to the drawing board for the person arguing against the green demon in the watch theory. But then the person claiming that they have a green demon in their watch, I know this is silly, can change the rules again. Like, well, there should still be, if he's only invisible, there should still be a presence. Well, if you try to detect the presence, he dematerializes. Most conspiracy theorists won't go that far about a lot of the theories that they push. But unfalsifiability is a real safety net for the conspiracy theorists when it comes time to evaluate the truth value of their claims. So those are the basics. I want to get right to the show at this point because this one runs long. This was the live show from the 15th. We planned to talk about this for the first hour only. We wound up devoting almost 3 hours to this discussion. And I hope this topic doesn't turn people off. I think that there's a lot of important material for us to cover in this Logic Saves Lives series, but I want to do it in a fun way. And for me, this Apollo hoax topic is like the most fun you could have, right? So we're trying to create shows where people can walk away with some real lasting enrichment, but it was all wrapped up in something that was fun and enticing. It's kind of like selling wheatgrass juice to people out of a truck that's shaped like a hot dog. It's not like that at all. And if you're listening to this show for some definitive answers about what the truth is behind the Apollo missions, you're going to be disappointed. Thanks for listening and take care. So, guys, right. Exciting show tonight, right?
I'm very excited.
Let's give the audience a little bit of a backstory here.
Oh, yes.
We've been doing a series on School Sucks for quite some time now. It actually started several months ago, and I called the series Logic Saves Lives because, really, there's a lot of irrational thinking, really all throughout time, but especially in the last 100 years, that has killed a lot of people. So we would think that heading that off in the future, if people understood some of the rules of logic and how to spot illogical or fallacious arguments, might help. As I always used to say to my students, good questions stop ridiculous ideas from becoming world religions. So that's the goal of this series. That's why it has that name. And this week, I want to talk about a group of fallacies, usually under the umbrella term, the fallacy of omission.
Oh, yeah.
Now, fallacies of omission are anything, as the name suggests, that leaves out necessary information to have a full understanding,
right,
of a certain topic. Or when a logician or a propagandist purposely misdirects people away from information that they would need to have a complete picture of whatever the subject is.
Yes.
Now, I didn't know how to go about doing this, but there were some very exciting developments over the course of the last week. I think I was driving, had my iPod, and I was listening to Free Talk Live. I actually just called Free Talk Live before the show to talk about this. And I also asked a friend of the show, a guy named Alan Murdoch from the Skeptical Libertarian. So I said, Alan, big topic tonight that you might be interested in. But he said he's not an expert on this topic. But none of us are.
No. How could you be?
No, that's the thing.
If I was an expert on this topic, I'd be making my own documentaries.
I think that that's the appeal of this topic, though.
And that's the appeal of a lot of conspiracy. How could you be an expert? And we're going to elaborate on that a little bit.
And I think if people find it very liberating to discover that you don't have to be an expert on something in order to have an opinion.
But can you become an expert by watching documentaries on YouTube?
Well, you know, you can become somebody who thinks they're an expert on something, but you need to evaluate the methodology that the filmmakers use in making their argument. I will say that the topic that we're talking about tonight is very controversial, very exciting. And I do want to treat it. I do want to approach it with humility and politeness. And I don't think we're trying something new.
As usual, I will not.
And Osborne doesn't have to. But I don't want to hack my way through the typical, oh, isn't it stupid that people believe this? What's wrong with them?
I don't think it's that stupid to believe it.
Because the conspiracy theory that we are going to talk about is the one that I want to believe more than any other conspiracy in the world.
Right.
Back to Free Talk Live. I'm in my car, have my iPod on. A caller brings up this idea about the Apollo mission hoax. Now, this is a common theory that the NASA could not get to the moon.
Right.
Right. So that these moonwalks and the lunar lander, that all that footage was done on a soundstage. But the delicious additive to the story was that one of my all-time favorite filmmakers, Stanley Kubrick, who, we could just go on and on about how great he is, the work he's done.
You could. I could not.
You're not a fan?
I can't say that I am or I am not. I just don't understand him.
I find him to be hit or miss, personally.
He's over my head.
The storytelling, like 2001, who knows, right?
Right.
Call in. We have open phones all night, 843-JOIN-SSP, Skype in, School Sucks Live. If you want to participate in any part of this conversation, our only rule is that we would like your calls to be on topic tonight, because this conversation could go in a lot of different ways.
And it's going to be so fun.
All right, so the caller says that there's a movie, a documentary, he calls it, and it's called The Shining Code. Now, for some reason in 1980, in the late 1970s, The Shining was released in 1980, right. Kubrick thought this might have been his last movie. And what he was going to do, he had other interests. He was a kind of a Renaissance man. So he wanted to embed a confession into The Shining that he participated in the hoax of the Apollo mission. Now,
right.
At this point, I'm in my car, driving to my brother's house. I start speeding, right? I get there. I grab my brother Blake by the arm. I say, we're watching a movie.
I also did this, except I was at my desk, so all I had to do was click a button.
Of all the conspiracies, like I said, this is the one that I want to believe the most, that the Apollo missions were a hoax, right? So what do we call that? When we want to believe something before we actually do the research, this is called confirmation bias.
Right.
Very popular. Media empires have grown up around people's needs to satisfy their confirmation bias. Fox News exists for that purpose. And New York Times has been around for a long time, but like just a television equivalent would be MSNBC.
Right.
I'm a liberal or a conservative. I want to hear people who look like they know what they're talking about because they're on television.
Except they agree with me.
Yeah. Say the same things that I do and say, oh, I knew I was right. That's confirmation bias. I have that in this case. Well, boy, was I excited, right? my brother and I, we sat down to watch it. And in 5 minutes, we were both in tears. Like, he was in tears of laughter, and I was in tears of sadness. Because I said, if this is the only evidence that Kubrick participated in the Apollo 11 and the subsequent Apollo missions, all the way up to 17, I think,
might have been
the last one that they did the moon.
They made that movie, Apollo 18, about the final moon mission that nobody knows about.
Yes.
Because everybody died.
I, on the other hand, cried tears of boredom after 5 minutes and had to turn it off. And I did read the summary page, which I'm saying 2 minutes, you can read the summary page.
Yeah.
Whereas the gentleman on the so-called documentary takes 47 minutes to read the same information.
It looks more like a PowerPoint presentation than a movie.
Okay, so we have a theory about how this film was actually developed. Now, Osborne suggested this in the pre-show.
Yes.
Now, I'll just give the moment in the film, and then you can go over the theory. That sounds good.
Okay.
All right. This movie, there's a version that's 47 minutes. There's a version that's an hour. It's called The Shining Code. In either version, there's one scene that lasts about 3 minutes where Danny, the boy, and we're just going to assume that everyone is familiar with the story of The Shining. It might be a good idea if you're listening to the podcast in the future to pause this and just get a synopsis of the film if you haven't seen it, or pause this and watch the movie. No reason why you couldn't
right?
do that.
Why not?
But Danny, the boy, is sitting on a rug playing with cars. And the pattern on the rug is a shape, is in shapes that is suggestive of the shape of the launch pads in Florida.
I guess.
For it's a similar shape. It's like maybe octagonal. And he slowly stands up and he's wearing a sweater that has a rocket on it. Now that maybe you could dismiss, but the rocket says Apollo 11 on it.
It does.
Then Danny walks to room 237, a change that Kubrick made from Stephen King's book, The Shining. It was room 217 that he went to. Now, Stephen King fans hate this movie because it doesn't follow the book.
Right, right.
Right. There's all these weird aberrations that a lot of them argue hurt the story as it's told in the movie. Whatever happens in room 237, which is just about the distance from the Earth to the moon, 237,000 miles, Danny, who The Shining Code claims represents one version of Kubrick, Jack Nicholson represents the other version of Kubrick, leaves room 237 and will not talk, as if he has been silenced. This is an extremely compelling piece of evidence. But what's the problem?
Well, I don't know if it's a problem or not, but my speculation is that someone was watching this movie, saw this particular scene that you just described, and said, now I am going to go hunt for every little thing that I can possibly connect to Apollo 11 and promote this theory.
Right.
That I have, that I just developed based on this one thing that I saw.
Right.
Now, how long ago did this guy make this movie?
Within the last few years, I would say.
Because I've been hearing that Kubrick was, like, I've been hearing the rumors about the faking of the moon landing and that Kubrick was involved in it for a very long time.
Yes.
For many years.
Yes. And, you know.
Yeah, so he probably already had it in his mind.
Well, right? I don't see how anyone who doesn't already think the moon landing was fake would look at that movie and go, holy shit, the moon landing is fake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you're saying that's not going to be the clincher for anyone?
I don't think so.
So we have to provide some context
okay.
for this. Now, what Osborne is describing, there is a trigger. There is something that is very compelling. And maybe what there's already murmurs and a little bit of buzz about as a theory. And then from there, the person operates on confirmation bias.
Mm-hmm.
And they say, I decide what I want to believe. I'm going to go like misuse the deductive method where I come up with a general principle and then I find things that will hold it up.
Right.
I will go hunt and it gets really, really silly. This movie is almost like a parody of a conspiracy. The connections are so far-fetched and loose, like all of these representations of the number 11.
Right.
So see how this shot is framed, where you could clearly see that these two things, like the things in every door,
right.
The panels in every door.
That exist on every door ever.
So he's finding all these 11s.
Yeah. There's two trees in this shot. They make an 11.
Right.
What does Scatman Carruthers represent?
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay. Sorry.
But all these 11s, right?
Right.
So every time we see up and down structures, which there happen to be a lot of indoors.
Wait. Never mind. We weren't going to do this.
Do what? Oh, we weren't going to get silly.
I was going to say, does this mean that the Spinal Tap movie is also about the Apollo 11 moon landing? Because they make a big fuss over the amps that go up to 11. 11.
No. Listen, we can rip this Shining Code movie to shreds, and we should, because it's crap.
Okay.
Right? what I said I wanted to treat respectfully was the ideas that Kubrick was involved and that the Apollo missions were a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
That, I think, deserves respect because I think it is just as plausible as the idea that people went to the moon.
Right.
Landed a thing on it, walked, and then got it back off the moon and came home.
Right. Whenever I've had a discussion about you know, the possibility of the moon landing being fake, people say, well, why would they fake a moon landing? And I think the better question is, why would they go all the way to the moon if they didn't have to?
Right. Yeah. I'm an economist, right?
Yeah.
So the inner economist in me wants to believe that they did not spend all that money sending a rocket to the moon for no reason, that someone pocketed that money and used it for something more worthwhile, like booze and hookers. Or
One of the ideas is that this is the money that this money was all funneled into the military industrial complex, and that the whole space race itself between the United States and the Soviet Union. And we're going to get to the backstory. We're going to give you some context of the plausibility of this theory. But the space race was kind of representative of the defense race of to see who was going to be the preeminent superpower.
Mm.
Right. So before we do that, I think we should lay down a contextual picture. Our chat is lighting up, and I've gotten a couple private messages on the Skype. But
really,
any pictures?
There's a picture of this man, but I think it's just his Skype ID, and it's just his face.
Mm.
So we'll see where the night goes. But why this is so plausible, this moon landing hoax thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before I get to that, I do want to say that I often feel with conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorists, and I'm not dismissive of the concept generally, history is conspiracy. Right. We have a book right here. I'll put it up. You're watching our cam show, The Underground History of American Education by John Taylor Gatto. This is a textbook size proof. People have conspired at different times for different reasons to control the public mind. Conspiracies are real.
Right.
But I think a lot of times people see plausibility, right? And they think that the road to provability is a smooth and a short one from there. Everything that has been introduced to us about the moon landing hoax theory is entirely plausible. It makes perfect sense. It almost makes too much sense. Like I said, don't let my confirmation bias distort this, because I really, really want to believe this. But let's set the stage. What was going on at this time period? Well, after World War II, the Cold War escalates, and it's really hot into the 50s and getting really, really hot into the 1960s.
Oh, yes.
Now, the Soviets were the first to space. The Soviets were the first to orbit the Earth, their Sputnik program. I think they had even landed a probe on the moon, unmanned. They were the first to get one of them monkeys in space,
right?
Which is a big, you want to put an animal up first?
They put a dog up first and then a monkey.
Oh, okay. So they had two animals in space before the United States had any.
I think it was even more than that. I know they put a dog up first. The first animal they put up was a dog.
Yeah.
And I think they might have done a cat, and they did a chimp. And then they did have a human orbit the Earth, and then they had the first spacewalk as well, the first extra vehicular activity in space.
Now, they had Yuri Gagarin, who he was the first man in space. I think he died in some kind of aeronautical accident shortly after that. Yeah, Yuri Gagarin was the first human in space that we know of. So, like I said, this is representative of how the arms race is going to go. Right.
If the United States was getting smoked in the space race.
So if they have this superior technology, you know, how in danger is the country? You know, and at this time, we've already had the Cuban Missile Crisis when they were moving nukes into this hemisphere. And early in the 1960s, John F. Kennedy, one president who I don't think was a terrible man, makes a promise. He's committed to this idea that the United States will put a man on the moon.
Man on the moon.
By
1970.
That's what he says.
Almost exactly like that.
He also said, we will go to the moon and do the other things.
Yeah.
Not one of his best quotes.
No, I think, well, out of context, he might have listed a bunch of other things before that.
Yeah.
And then out of context, it just makes no sense.
Yeah.
Or it always sounded to me like he just kind of forgot what he was going to say. We will go to the moon and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
And then he's assassinated, and there's all this emotional baggage of that. So they got it in there just at the nick of time, July 1969. Right. So that's one aspect of this. There's two aspects. We have the Soviet arms race,
right?
Which is the whole space race is just representative of. It doesn't matter, like, what we're going to spend all this money to get rocks. you know?
Well, there was also a very specific fear that the Soviets were going to build like an orbital platform that could drop nukes on us.
Yeah. And they say that this is also the genesis for the United States, that NASA was the genesis of the Star Wars program
right.
that was talked about so much in the 80s.
Yes.
Now, the often overlooked factor is the socio-political condition of the United States in the late 1960s.
Yes.
Right? So we have the Vietnam War. We have all of the protests, the anti-war movement, the embattled presidents, Johnson and then Nixon. We have the civil rights movement. Within 18 months of the moon landing, you have the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy
mm-hmm.
and Martin Luther King a few months earlier. These were considered to be like the last great hopes for that generation.
Right.
You know, both cut down. And I don't know how much suspicion there was about those assassinations then. I don't know how much suspicion there was about the Kennedy assassination. I would think that people were generally similar to how they are today, that they basically believed what
they were told.
Authorities told them.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of fervor in American culture. And this event united everybody. People talk about national pride. I don't know why you get credit for somebody else's accomplishments because they're on the same landmass as you, but that was a thing.
The same reason you refer to your entire country as we.
And it diffused only temporarily. But if it had not happened, you know, how much faster would things have escalated and where could they have gone?
Right.
Considering everything that had preceded that event in the 1960s. But this seems to diffuse a lot of the tension, and it provides at least a moment for people to pause and say, yeah, we did something good. And it also relieves all of that collective anxiety about the situation with the Soviets. So it has all these benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Year prior, what's this fantastic movie that comes out?
2001.
Space Odyssey.
A Space Odyssey.
One of my all-time favorite movies. That's thoughts, feelings? Very,
I have never seen it.
You're kidding me. We should watch it right now.
Kid you not.
Does the audience mind in the chat? Do you mind if we watch 2001 Space Odyssey? If you're not watching us on video, I don't know how good it'll be because there's only 20 minutes of dialogue in the whole movie.
Yeah, the rest is just weird spaceship background noise.
Nice music. He used to play music on the set, too. Like, if you've ever seen, and one of the things that I watched in preparation for tonight's show was a documentary that Vivian Kubrick, his daughter, made behind the scenes about The Shining.
Right.
You know, because what I wanted to see is if it was identifiable, any kind of methodology. Is he going out of his way to set things up a certain way? Which, I mean, you could tell if you're rewriting parts of the script, which he was doing every day. You see him sitting there with a typewriter rewriting things and handing it to Jack Nicholson, and Jack Nicholson saying, I guess we just make this up as we go. A very frustrating movie to work on. Aside from Kirk Douglas, I don't think any actor ever worked with Kubrick more than once.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
Because he was very, very demanding, and he pushed people. You see Shelley Duvall, who played Jack Nicholson's wife in the movie, like practically in tears. Her hair is falling out on the set. His methods were interesting, and I don't think a lot of actors were too fond of the process.
Maybe he's why Tom Cruise went crazy.
Mm. We are moving slowly.
We are broadcasting live from our moon studio.
Whoa.
You can't disprove it.
We're moving, like I said, a little bit slower than we anticipated tonight because we also wanted to talk about another documentary when we realized what a failure The Shining Code was. Like, it's not even fair of us, I think, to take the movie apart because it makes such a weak argument. And it really got me thinking about conspiracies in general and how a lot of conspiracies really rely upon fallacies of omission, which is what we want to talk about
right.
in our logical fallacies. So we're going to go through some of the common ones. But before we do that, one of the reasons why the moon landing, the Apollo hoax theory is so compelling, it's so ripe for conspiracy theory, you know, because very, very few people can have the background knowledge, you know, the grammar to really understand enough of the information necessary to be able to evaluate the claims one way or the other.
Right.
Well, yeah, combine that with how they so strictly control media access to the operation as well. So, you throw up the veil and you say, hey, we're doing this stuff behind the veil. Well, of course, everyone's going to think you're pulling one over on them.
I think that that's certainly part of it, too. But like, if people don't have the background knowledge, like, I mean, you would need to be an expert on radiation. You would need to be an expert on physics. You would need to be an expert on aerospace technology, even like photography. What drove most of the conspiracy theories about the moon landing being fake? First and foremost, the photography, I think, was what people felt was like a giveaway, right? There's all these anomalies in the photography. And again, once people found one thing that they couldn't explain, they shot right down that road from plausibility to provability.
Right.
And that was one of the fallacies of omission right there. When you say, well, if you can't explain this, you know, the appeal to ignorance, if you can't explain why this is there, then I get to say this is clearly fake.
Right.
Which is a logical fallacy. But we have things like the photography. It appears as if there's shadows that go in different directions.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which would indicate multiple light sources, multiple like on a movie source. Set. Because, with a moving flag.
Yeah. Now, oh, the flag's another one. But why would all the light be going in one direction? Why are all the shadows going in one direction?
Because there's only really one light source if you're standing on the moon, and that's the sun.
Sure. But we only have like one light source during the day on right. Earth, and shadows are not parallel.
No, but like two people standing next to each other are going to have their shadows cast in the same direction.
That depends on how close together they are. That depends on how far away they are from the light source. In fact, if you would see that the light coming from behind them will cast a shadow that at first might appear to be somewhat parallel, but they, as you follow the line to the vanishing point, they should actually at some point off in the distance, even though the shadows are not that long, if you followed the lines, they should converge.
Yeah.
Right. So if you put a light source really close to something, and you guys can test this at home if you're listening, if you put a light source real close to like a couple of objects, you'll see that the shadows from those objects appear to spread out away from each other. But if you use a light source very, very distant, like the sun, you could put a couple objects next to each other and you see that because the light source is further away, the shadows will actually start pointing towards each other. Now, if you have a shadow that's going at like two shadows that are at 90 degree angles right. of each other, that's a little bit harder to explain.
Yeah.
But another problem aside from the shadows was the resolution of the film, right? So a lot of these pictures that were available that circulated on the internet, you know, in 240 resolution, 360 resolution, and people said, oh, you know, there's these little X marks on the film to measure like distances, I think.
Yeah.
And sometimes it appears that they're like in front of the objects and sometimes they're behind the objects. Like there's one with a flag, right?
Right.
And it looks like they should always be in front of everything because they're printed on the film.
Right.
But one, it appears to be behind the flag. But it's just the fact that the flag is blown out. The light of the flag right. is blown
that
out.
That doesn't even make sense.
The low resolution of the film. So, what about the flag?
What is that? The person is that person then claiming that those X's are not actually printed on the film, that they're somewhere on the set, and they accidentally placed the flag in front of one of them?
No,
I don't even understand how that's.
No, the idea is that they doctored the photo after the fact, or they combined two pictures
okay.
somehow.
Okay.
Yeah, but again, that's appeal to ignorance, mm-hmm. right? Saying, "Well, if you can't explain this, I get to say this other thing."
Right.
So. The other one is the flag. What's the story with the flag? And what we're talking about was the movie, because after we got away from The Shining Code, I took a very disappointing walk away from that and suggested another one that we all watched called...
A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon.
A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, which...
Narrated by Queen Elizabeth I, as far as I can tell.
And I still don't believe that Queen Elizabeth talks. I don't believe that royal people talk.
No, she does.
I think they're too inbred. Too many generations.
I must say, I watched
reading.
That today,
yeah.
and I soaked up every single thing that they talked about, other than the weird Bible talk.
The weird succession of Bible quotes.
But
you know what I really did love, actually, was the montage. It was some kind of a jazz standard song that I'm actually not familiar with about going to the moon. I want to say it was Fly Me to the Moon, but it wasn't. It was something similar. But they played it over a montage of just rockets crashing back to Earth.
Well, yeah, so that's how they start the movie, right? With it's just government being government, right? Where you show million-dollar things blowing up, and they're like, ooh, build another million-dollar thing.
How do these guys get anything right?
So, like, they never could have done this because look at all this stuff that blew up.
Right.
Right? You don't have any indication of where that footage is. That footage could be from the early 50s, some of it. Right? So it's misleading. And there's also
stacking
this,
the deck.
This emotional appeal. They're using Bible quotes. Yeah, stacking the deck is another example of an omission fallacy where, now, folks, if you're just joining us, I so want to believe this is true. I cross my fingers and close my eyes, and I want to believe that the Apollo missions are a hoax. Stanley Kubrick directed them. I want a t-shirt that says it with a picture. But unfortunately, reason at this point doesn't allow it. And that's why I want to keep the phones open. If you have evidence, if you have something that can be convincing. Osborne, you say that you felt like the arguments that were made in that film.
Yeah, it made sense to me because I had no way of disproving it. They're talking a lot about photography and whatnot, and I have no reason to know anything about that.
But that's, I think, part of the plausibility and the longevity of this conspiracy is that it's very difficult to disprove because, like I said before, very few people have the background knowledge necessary to evaluate it. Like they say, oh, a flag blows, you see this flag flapping around that clearly shows that there's wind. Well, the flag has an aluminum pole in it,
right?
Now, if you stick an aluminum pole in hard ground, the pole's going to go boom, 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 like that. And
especially
if there's no gravity,
you're twisting the pole too.
Yeah, and then there's
twist it with your hand, it's going to flap around a little bit.
So there's no gravity, there's no air resistance, there's nothing to stop it or slow it down under the conditions that we normally observe. So it might look like it, you know, waves back and forth because of the vibration of the pole. I mean, you can explain it either way, or you can say, yeah, it was a soundstage and they had the air conditioning on, right? So there's really no...
Because no one while they were filming would have noticed, hey, the flag is moving. Maybe we should, you know.
Right. Yeah. They say that there is no telescope powerful enough in the world that could show you the...
So what they're saying is no one can confirm whether that flag is actually there.
Right. So the unfalsifiability in this case goes both ways.
Mm-hmm.
Now...
Why didn't they like use their, you know, like when you're at the beach and you like draw like pictures in the sand with your foot, why didn't they make a giant flag in the dust?
So just bring a bigger flag.
Because they didn't do that, they're clearly lying.
Unless they left the air conditioner on the moon on, then it would blow away.
Right.
So anyway, the flag is another one. And then there's the Van Allen radiation belt, which I think starts about 1,000 miles above beyond the Earth. And it's kind of
there's two of them and there's a gap in between them.
Yeah.
But the first one starts about 1,000 miles up, if I remember correctly.
And I believe they were discovered by this Dr. Van Allen in the early days of space exploration.
Hence the name.
Yeah. There's very little that I could find about what he had to say about it. But the claim in all these films is that human beings would die basically as soon as they entered it. So travel more than 1,000 miles away from the Earth is impossible. All subsequent missions after Apollo never went more than 500 miles away.
Right.
But there's more to that story. And now we have Nicholas on the phone. He is in Australia. I'm going to warn everybody that if you're watching us live, this is all going to be fixed in post, but there might be a little bit of a delay. So we're just going to tolerate that so we can get through Nicholas's call. Nicholas, are you with us?
It's a pleasure to be on the show again. I really enjoy all the work that you guys do.
Thank you very much. So what are your general thoughts on this topic, or did you want to take us in a certain direction?
Well, no agenda at all, because I think you guys are doing a fantastic job on it. But I guess both the documentaries you've mentioned I've seen, the first one, that it's rubbish.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really fair either. It's someone has put effort into it, and somebody who perhaps hasn't had the background in the Trivium stuff or had the pleasure of speaking to yourself or to Richard Grove or to James Corbett, people like that, has put it together with a sincere effort, and that's good. But I think Dave Widener does a much better job because he focuses on the production side of it rather than whether or not the moon landing happened or things like that. And the Kubrick stuff does, the Shining stuff does come into it, of course, but less so, more about the way that 2001 was shot with front screen projection and things like that.
Now, that's some grammar that we should understand. What does front screen projection? Because in these documentaries, they talk about things in kind of a passing way,
right?
In a very authoritative way. Oh, yeah, front screen projection. But they never really explain it thoroughly so the layman can say, ah, okay, that makes sense. So what does that mean, front screen projection? So we're saying that 2001, this was a relatively new technology, but what is it, and why should that piece of information be compelling?
again, I think Jay does a really good job of explaining. He goes into a lot of detail. He gives you a lot of examples in the first film that he's done two films on it now. The first film, he takes you in and he shows you all the different examples. And in the actual film itself, in 2001, not on the moon, he gets to the moon footage later and demonstrates how it might be front screen projection, but he shows a definite case of it first. From my understanding, front screen projection is a method of basically we would use a blue screen or a green screen these days, but it's basically we build a set and then through the lens of the camera, you pre-roll some footage that has the background of whatever you want and you project that onto the front of the camera rather than, so basically the director or the cinematographer looking through the viewfinder can see what's happening, but the actors just have to guess based on their set.
Right.
Sure. Okay.
Before that, they used to use rear screen projection where the actors would stand in front of a projector screen and there was a projector on the other side of the screen projecting the image. And that's front screen projection was the new updated version of that that they used in 2000.
Well, Kubrick invented it.
Yeah.
He mastered it.
Yeah. Now, my comments on Kubrick as a filmmaker, like one of the things that I'm into even more than stories a lot of the times is the technical skills of a filmmaker. So my favorites are Kubrick and Scorsese because they do these amazing things that hardly anybody else has ever done or ever tried. And the camera is often somewhat of a character in their films. The hyperspace scene, the Infinity and Beyond scene, was done with paper.
Yeah.
Projecting light through paper and then filming it in a certain way. Somewhat related to this, so you guys might be familiar with the film Barry Lyndon. This was another one of those pieces of evidence, Nicholas, that people found compelling, is that...
It's a good point because of the way he used the lens to get the... and I hope I'm not stealing your thunder here, but the candlelight and get it just right in terms of the technical aspects of the lighting on the lens.
Sure. And the story goes that he actually obtained the Zeiss lens, which interestingly is that now our, just to show you where technology has come, our webcams have Zeiss lenses in them. Huh. But the camera was used to photograph spy satellites. That was its purpose, in complete darkness. So it had, a really fast shutter, like a super light sensitive camera. Because Barry Lyndon took place in Victorian England and everything needed to be lit by candles. Mm-hmm. And they just did not have camera technology that had the shutters fast enough to pick up that kind of light.
Right.
So he obtains this camera from NASA, supposedly, of which there's one in the world. And that was something that also, I guess, raised some eyebrows for a lot of people. Like, why did he have this relationship with NASA? But obviously, even if there was no staging of the Apollo missions, they would have had a relationship with NASA. In fact, I think that people in government were shown rushes of 2001 while they were filming it, because it was something that, of course, everyone was very excited about, and they needed consultation from experts, most of whom at the time, because of the Apollo project, worked at NASA. So there was a relationship between Kubrick and NASA, if for no other purpose than technical guidance on 2001.
Yeah, but Brett, also don't forget that Kubrick really annoyed the CIA with Strangelove. He really annoyed them with the way that he was able to reproduce the B-52, because he asked them for assistance there in the same way that you're talking about 2001, and they rejected him. And he went ahead and did it anyway and pretty much got it spot on. So, I mean, that complicates what you're saying a little bit. It's a very problematic subject, and I think that we really do need to have a lot of logical resilience when we're looking at this, to question everything twice.
That's easy enough, right? I mean, they forced him to do it because they were, as payback for how he pooped on them over the Strangelove.
Well, it's an interesting thing to contemplate, and I even thought at one point it maybe the three of us would try to role play this as if we were trying to plan such a conspiracy. Now, could somebody really say no? What's at stake if he was approached and asked to do this? Even
you were assuming he was asked,
that he didn't volunteer Or
no, that they didn't give him a choice.
I'm giving them like the benefit of the doubt that
why
they
on earth
made it. You know, well, you get asked to pay taxes by, you know, somebody's kind of like casually waving a gun, not pointing it at you, but just sort of waving around saying, oh, you know, you really should do this. But okay, I take your point that he might, that was my point actually, that he might not have felt like there was a choice. And another thing, even though this is somewhat speculative, I have heard that because of everything that was at stake, Nicholas, with the space race and how it related to the arms race, that the idea, and I think you mentioned this to me in your chat, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin exploding on TV also would have been bad. We're trying to take the position, a skeptical position here, but I think that there's also a way to go too far in that the default position for a lot of skeptics would be the more massive a conspiracy is in scale, the more implausible it is, right? Mm-hmm. Because like small conspiracies that might involve, you know, a focused finite group of people are more believable because it would be more rational in the whole risk versus reward sense. It wouldn't be so irrational to try and get away with something. So I think a lot of the skepticism around 9/11, when people start getting into building demolition and stuff like that, when skeptics evaluate the risk versus reward of that, it's pretty far for people to stick their neck out for what was the reward that they would get from having these three buildings demolished. And that might be a topic for another time. But go ahead, Nicholas.
Well, I was just going to say it's a little bit incredulous because I mean then they turn around on the other hand and say I'm just doing my job, sir. No, I just do what I'm told, sir. Like, well, you can't have it both ways. If you're not willing to question what you're being told, then you have to accept that there can be a conspiracy that's run from the top down.
Sure.
And on the other hand, if you disagree that there's a culture of conspiracy that can be organized, I mean, what did demolition companies, what do they question every building they demolish? They're like, oh, hang on, I don't know if we should demolish this building on this date. Like, no, they go, is the money in the bank? Yes, let's pull down a building. And I think it'll be the same with NASA. You know, you got so many different companies that would be interacting here that they're not all going to have a view of the master plan of what's going on. And the same on a film. I'm a filmmaker myself, and it's like you have so many different departments that have to, I mean, it's me and two other guys in this sense, but I know what it's like. You have so many different departments that have to communicate with each other that you need one or two people to get a bird's eye view. And those people have an advantage in terms of power in right. that respect.
I don't know why it's easier. Like, people have a problem believing that that many people could cooperate to fake a moon landing, which is relatively easy because the same people have no problem believing that that many people cooperated to actually conduct a moon landing.
But the problem is the secrecy, right? So when
how many of those, like, well, I think what Nicholas was sort of getting at there, if I understood correctly, is that not everybody involved needs to know that it's fake.
Well, yeah, that's called compartmentalization, too. Mm-hmm. And compartmentalization is that there could be the Manhattan Project is a good example of this. People were building different things in different places, and obviously they weren't told. No one was saying, you know, here's the big picture, guys. Let's have a meeting on Friday so we can discuss the big picture. You know, it was very compartmentalized for security reasons, if nothing else.
Right.
So there's no reason why other projects couldn't work that way, too. Now, I think the position of default skepticism is generally good. Right?
Oh, yes.
But the idea that a conspiracy becomes implausible the larger it gets in scale omits important considerations like the compliance of the media, the impact of public relations and government schooling on the public, the natural propensity towards obedience through the way schooling and parenting works in this country and around the world. And really the hubris of a lot of the people in power. I mean, if you just listen to the speech of the average politician, who is little more than a hand puppet, I think, you know, for the people who really hold power, they have absolutely no respect for the intelligence of the average person.
Right.
And I think that there's a lot that isn't considered. And I think all of that stuff goes along with the idea of compartmentalization. But I also think that the presentations that are available from what I've seen so far, Nicholas, on this topic, which I've said now probably for the fifth time in this show, I really want to believe this. for entertainment purposes. This is a very sexy conspiracy theory. But especially
I've got an Expanse poster I can sell you, by the way.
Especially once Kubrick gets involved. But it just doesn't pass logical muster. And I think that
Hang on, let's stop there. What is it specifically that is challenging you on this? Because I think it is plausible. And
oh, it's absolutely plausible.
Believe, what's stopping you? I mean, that's the real question tonight on the show, is what is stopping Brett Vanat from believing that Stanley Kubrick was involved in faking the moon? Let's go there.
Because the logic that's used to present these ideas does not hold up. These fallacies are so prevalent. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you were saying that you didn't want to talk about the quality, the production quality of the documentaries that you watch, particularly the one that led to the show happening tonight. So,
I'll deal more with the other one. I'll deal more with A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon, where they're trying to make scientific arguments. But the problem is I think that the scientific arguments that the film
is that the documentary though.
No. There's a mockumentary called The Dark Side of the Moon, which is an intentionally deceiving version of the Kubrick conspiracy, where they interview Donald Rumsfeld and Henry Kissinger, and they like cut their interviews up so it looks like they're talking about pitching the idea to Kubrick. It's worth watching. It's very clever if you have time for that. But A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Moon was a legitimate attempt to prove this story. The problem is that the filmmakers seem to presuppose that people are not going to have the requisite scientific knowledge to evaluate their claims effectively. The whole Van Allen radiation belt in the film, they make a claim like, you know, the craft was so thin and it needed to be shielded in lead to protect them from radiation. But does heavy metal, if you're not a scientist, if you're not a physicist, if you're not electrical, astrophysics, if you're not in a, like, are we needing heavy metals or light metals? Are we conducting radiation? How dangerous is the Van Allen belt? The only comment that I could find from Van Allen was he said 2 days of exposure would kill a human being. They had to spend a total of the trip in and the trip out, an hour and a half going through this area. So there's nothing convincing.
But how do we know the area even exists? I mean, that's my question. I mean, if we haven't sent someone to the moon, then how do we know the Van Allen belt exists? And if we have something to the moon, then it defeats the purpose of being raised in discussion.
Apparently, the claim that Van Allen discovered this goes back to the 50s during the early space exploration.
Well, I mean, I want to talk about the fact that we can't learn anything from one documentary on YouTube.
Sure.
That's ridiculous, and that you have to look at it as entertainment. And a lot of the stuff you have to look at as entertainment. But in terms of I'm definitely interested in what you find incredulous about the idea, because I think the idea is very plausible.
Oh, no. I thought I clarified that I totally think that it's entirely plausible. I think my desire to believe this also comes with a need for proof. And if you're just joining us, we've been talking about the idea of the Apollo missions being a hoax. I am saying now for the sixth time that this is the conspiracy that I want to believe most in the world. We've gone over some reasons, and Nick pointed out to me during the break that I might not have been entirely clear about this, but I entirely believe that this is plausible. And I think we've talked about how, why wouldn't this even be more likely?
Yeah, I would go beyond plausible and to say I think it's more likely that they faked it than
right.
they didn't.
Sure, but
I would go so far as to say I believe it.
Okay.
The same way that we talked about earlier during the break, that I believe that there's salami in my refrigerator right now.
And
can't prove it, don't know that for sure, I believe it.
Yeah, and I think that this is such, there's so much emotional investment for me in this topic that I really need proof. I really want proof, right? I was very disappointed with the films that we saw. Nick, as you pointed out, we can't really, expect a documentary on YouTube to solve everything for us.
I think the makers of those documentaries do expect that.
Yeah, sure.
The people who are making these documentaries perhaps are doing it out of, you talk a lot on this show about nonviolent communication. So what is the need that making a documentary about faking the moon landing is satisfying? And I mean, these people aren't wealthy or using high production value to make it. It's, I mean, if Richard Andrew Grove or yourself or some other people in the community, maybe Ground Zero might be able to do a good job. I mean, Ground Zero did a show on the moon landing anomalies when Neil Armstrong died. And they spent 3 hours talking about it and talking about, you know, the Nazi involvement and Project Paperclip and Werner Brum. Brennan and I can't pronounce his name and all that. There's a lot of stuff that is weird, and I think necessarily so. NASA is a weird organization, and Curiosity on Mars is weird, and there's a lot of weirdness, but that doesn't mean it's a conspiracy. So
yeah, and I just want to be careful too. Like, in the a funny thing happened on the way to the moon. They spend the first 6 minutes or so trying to create this, Corey, you said it was like, it's kind of like an emotional momentum where they're quoting right. the Bible and they're talking about all these other conspiracies. And the fact that other conspiracies exist are not really, really don't even need to enter into the discussion of whether or not this film, this topic for this film is a conspiracy or not. It should be able to exist on its own.
And right. They also stack the deck in the beginning of the movie by opening with immediately after all the Bible quotes, which are all about the hubris of men, of humans overreaching.
Yeah.
They immediately segue into like a 5-minute montage of exploding rockets on the landing pad.
Sure. Right. I think one of the reasons too, why I wanted to take this more skeptical stance is to keep people, thinking about confirmation bias and how ubiquitous that is in popular culture, and how we have, as Michael Shermer says, these believing brains, where if people decide that it's emotionally or politically expedient to believe a thing, they circumvent that logical process and go right to the belief, right? Because there's some kind of emotional reward to do so. So I want to point out, maybe I overstated a little bit, but I'm, going through a process on this, and I did not feel that the background knowledge provided was sufficient, and I didn't feel the way that was communicated through the logic or the rhetoric was entirely effective. So I walked away from everything that I've seen so far, and we were watching this version of Red Ice Radio with the gentleman you suggested, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. And I hadn't gotten through enough of it to find any part of it particularly convincing. But the plausibility is beyond a doubt. And I think that one thing that people who are looking at some of these theories need to remember, as I said earlier in the show, is that often we see the road from plausibility to provability as too short and too smooth.
Yeah, it's like Miami getting LeBron and thinking that the road to the ring is straightforward. It doesn't happen.
Nick, you're
work that needs to be done.
You're sounding very American. Hot dogs and basketball. Well, hey, listen, thank you so much for participating in this conversation. It was great to have you on. It was great to be able to put some of your knowledge and thoughts into this conversation, and we look forward to hearing from you again in the future, sir.
Anytime, Brett. And I just hope that we haven't gone too far away from talking about the logical fallacies of omission, because that was I was going to ask next, so I guess I'll leave on that. Is what do you think is being directly omitted from these, besides the background knowledge? And I guess we also need to ask is, what is the need that was fulfilled by making this? Thank you very much for your time and letting me on your show, and I look forward to your the rest of the show.
All right, thanks, Nick. Have a good night. All right, so I think that's an interesting question, and doing some exploration. I mean, it's obviously that's partly speculative, but why would somebody make a documentary? What kind of need would they be trying to get? Because, I mean, everything we do is really about trying to fulfill some right. kind of need.
Well, I think these people are the people who are making these documentaries are clearly so convinced that they've got it all figured out, and they're so outraged that the government, that our United States government would perpetrate something like this, that they feel everybody needs to know. And
yeah.
if they could just bring it to light, then it would change everything.
I think we've heard a lot of similar things with 9/11, right? That if people just understood that the government did this, it would change everything.
And I don't necessarily think that's true.
I believe that no matter what you showed certain people, their cognitive dissonance, another thing that we talk about on the show frequently, right, would just overpower whatever facts became available and crystal clear about an event like that.
I think there are also plenty of people who, if it was presented to them, like in an undeniable way, that the government was behind something like 9/11, then the next thing they would do is immediately fall back on, well, they must have had a really good reason.
Yeah, well, and Molyneux has been talking recently over and over again about how the science shows that when you confront people with contradictory evidence to their beliefs, that they actually dig in their heels and hold their beliefs even stronger than they did before the contrary evidence.
Which is an emotional self-defense,
yeah,
right? Because what are the implications of that? What's at stake? I've been deceived. I've been lied to. I'm stupid. I'm gullible.
Santa Claus isn't real.
People who cared about me weren't honest with me. You know, there's all of that stuff comes with it. So, you know, I've even thought about that, you know, the next time I get into one of these conversations, asking somebody, like, what's at stake for you? What if? Can you walk me through what happens to you emotionally, right, if it turns out that you're wrong? Would you be willing to do that before we even start having this discussion? Because if they say, no, I'm not doing that, right?
Right.
And I think that's an important thing for us to do as well. You know, we are going to deal with a whole other topic tonight on the show. I don't think we're going to get to it, but cognitive distortions.
Mm-hmm.
And cognitive distortions are when emotion gets in the way of logic. And
right.
Emotional intelligence is a big part of this. We are going to go into, dare I say, overtime. That's what Bill Maher calls it. I don't want to say overtime, no.
After show.
The after show, the After School Sucks special. We'll continue to move along with this topic because, interesting story, the original caller who called into Free Talk Live to discuss the Shining code has called us and wants to participate in this conversation. He's not on the phone with us right now, but I said once we're off LRN at midnight, he could call back in and we would give him we'll give him our full attention.
And he's in a different time zone even, he'll be able to stay up late.
Absolutely. Right now we have Alan Murdoch on the phone with us, and he is one of the founders of the Skeptical Libertarian. Is that the name, Alan?
The Skeptical Libertarian, yes, sir.
And you have been watching our live stream, and you've been participating in the chat, and you had some thoughts or questions on this topic.
Right. It was, first of all, it was a little bit muddy to me exactly what the conspiracy was that the previous caller was wanting to address. It's not clear whether or not the issue is that the Apollo 11 mission specifically was faked, or that all moon landings are faked, or is it specifically that Kubrick was involved in the faking? And that's one of the things that when you're talking to people as a skeptic, you have to get sort of made very clear from the outset is what is the specific claim that you're making, and then we can move from there. Like, what is the case that you're making, and then what is your evidence? And then if you're going to be a good critical thinker, you have to go and seek out contrary evidence. You can't just say someone made a plausible sounding argument and used lots of science terms that I don't understand, and so therefore I assume that they're smart and they know.
Right, yeah.
If I was afraid there was going to be a lot of detailed technical scientific knowledge that I just wasn't going to be able to address because I'm not an expert, I would have to look that stuff up.
No, I think that that's a pointless conversation because that's the steer around for the people who make these movies. They talk as mm-hmm. if they have some kind of scientific expertise, and they make these definitive statements about radiation, and the layman mm-hmm. just has to say, geez, they really sound like they know what they're talking about. It's the same thing right. with like when politicians or people in the media use inflated language in an attempt to like exaggerate their intellect, like Greenspan. Greenspan was the best at it. He would say a bunch of shit that right. nobody else could understand, and they'd be like, geez, this guy is smart.
So, yeah, and he later admitted it too, right? He called it Fed Talk.
Fed Speak, and it was also called Greenspeak. So, I didn't want to get into that kind of a conversation because I think that's your typical conspiracy theory, try to talk a circle around somebody. And then if they don't understand, you just say, oh, well, you know, you're dumbed down and you're. And I think it's too much of a go-to on this show for us, too. Like, because if our fallback can always just be, oh, well, it's because everybody's dumbed down and they can't understand what we're talking about. Like, they don't get the non-aggression right. principle because they spend 15,000 hours in government school. That's cheating. And I think the thing, too, that was my important statement about plausibility is that people try to take that shortcut that they shouldn't take. Of course, all of these things are plausible. Almost every conspiracy that I've ever heard contains a tremendous amount of plausibility. The problem is, where do we go from there? And obviously, it seems like a lot of the times people want to take shortcuts. But the theory is, I mean, because we were thinking, I mean, you raise a really good point, because during our pre-show tonight, we were talking about the possibility of trying to role play some of this stuff as if we were the conspirators. And we could do the moon landing, or we could pick a new one. But the most important question, first of all, is who are we even? Right? We're three guys sitting at a table, but what do we represent? Are we politicians? Are we corporations? Are we some other kind of, shadowy elites? Are we part of some foundation? It's hard to even get that kind of clarity. And this is one of the reasons why I'm such an admirer of Gatto's work, is he names names. He takes excerpts out of their writing. And, you know, he shows kind of a clear progression of what was not a unified plan by a single group of men, 12 men sitting around a table, but has been a common agenda. And it's certainly a very common sense agenda to have significant control over the public mind. But he makes a very, very convincing case using a lot of evidence, using a lot of primary sources, using a lot of quotes, explaining agendas, explaining the origins of organizations. And while people might say that my entire thesis on School Sucks Project is a conspiracy, yeah, it is a conspiracy, but there's very little theory left in it. And some of these other things that I have no problem believing, but I wouldn't argue as if they are definitively provable, i.e. 9/11, i.e. the Apollo missions. But the idea is that all of the Apollo missions were faked, because at the time between 1968, when the program was in its final stages of development, till 1972, when the final Apollo mission supposedly went, which I think was 17, it was not possible. The technology did not exist to put a man on the moon and to get him back off again and back to Earth. So that...
Now, is that... Would you take the position that that claim that there was no... You know, that technology would not have been possible. Would you assert that that is a claim that could be proven or disproven? I'm not asking if you take a position on it, but that is a claim that someone could investigate and find out?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it seems plausible to me.
I think the problem is how is that propagated? Would enough people understand why that claim that the science did or did not exist is provable? Do enough people have that background knowledge necessary to come to that conclusion definitively that, yeah, it was either yes or no, possible or not possible?
Well, I mean, you know, similarly, there has never been any article in any peer-reviewed scientific journal that has taken the position that the moon rocks, which were brought back from the moon, were not, in fact, moon rocks. I mean, unless you're going to take the position that, you know, all scientists who have ever published in any peer-reviewed scientific journal from any country on Earth, you know, they're all involved in that conspiracy. Or, I mean, that they got the moon rocks in some other way or something. I mean, you know, that's the sort of counter evidence that has to be brought in to an argument like this. Now, someone's going to take the position that, well, I don't believe things that are published in peer-reviewed scientific journals, well, then you go, okay, but we're not having a conversation about science anymore. What you want to rely on is, you know, some deep-seated, maybe not totally misguided distrust of government that you might have. I'm all for that. But once you move beyond that and you start saying, well, I'm going to ignore the science and rely on, you know, this gut feeling that I have, this guy who said some sciencey things, these two people who were connected in some weird way that seems ominous to me, and you're going to say, well, that counts as proof. Well, no, that doesn't count as proof. That's a story, and it might even be a good story. It might be a well-written story.
But, well, it is you know, kind of a, it is, Alan, kind of a haphazard use of the deductive method of reasoning, where people could make a general rule that government is dishonest, government has an agenda, and there's obviously been enough history to cite to establish that that can function as, I don't want to say a principle, but a general rule that all governments deceive their people for politically expedient reasons and agendas. And then what could be put in underneath that is the idea that science has been politicized for the sake of the government, the same way the other things that lead to important social revolutionary changes have been subsumed by the government, i.e. education and the arts through subsidies. But you're right that that is, even though it's an attempt at the deductive method, it's a little hasty.
And this is, by the way, not the only conspiracy theory about just about Stanley Kubrick, right? There's a whole conspiracy industry about his ties to, you know, whatever it is, the Masons or the Illuminati or whatever. You know, this is actually the first time I've heard of the moon hoax theory about Kubrick, but I'm familiar with these other claims about, and, you know, Kubrick's life apparently sort of lends itself to that sort of thing because he was clearly insane. I mean, he was a brilliant filmmaker, but he was a crazy person. And the more erratic someone's behavior is, I think probably the easier it is for us to assume that, well, that doesn't look like necessarily how someone should act in that situation, so there must be something else going on. When sometimes the other thing going on is just that the person is, I shouldn't say crazy, I should say an eccentric.
Sure.
That's what we say about crazy people who make art. They're eccentric.
Or who are rich.
You know? Yes. Right.
And I also wanted to address some of the other things that you guys were talking about, sort of tangential to this, that, you know, might have been plausible reasons, like this whole thing about the arms race. You know, the Soviets successfully tested their first nuclear bomb, and I want to say it was like 1959. I mean, you double-check me on Wikipedia to make sure I've got my history straight, but that is my understanding. So at that point, there is an arms race. There is a Soviet Union, and they have the bomb.
Right. Alan, hold on, you know, one second. If you're listening to us on the radio, sorry, we're out of time. But if you're listening to us at schoolsucksproject.com/live, lucky you. We're about to keep going in 1 minute with Alan Murdoch. We just have to let our music bed play out, take a 30-second pause, and then we will resume with this topic and the After School Sucks special. We're not even going to take a break. We've got Alan on the phone. We're going to keep going. Alan, can you hang on 1 minute?
Absolutely.
All right. If you're listening to us on LRN.FM, please check us out at schoolsucksproject.com/live if you're interested in this discussion. We will be back in a flash. All right. We're clear of LRN.
That's what I
wanted to say. All right. Alan, are you there?
Yes, sir.
And Sam, you are still there?
Yep.
Okay. Sam was the one who brought this whole theory to our attention about a week ago on Free Talk Live. So I wanted to give him an opportunity to respond to what he heard. But Alan, if you have any final thoughts on the track we were following, I'll keep you guys on together. But Alan, if there's anything else that you wanted to finish up first, you can do that.
Well, you guys actually, just in your sort of casual conversation about this, covered a lot of really good points. You know, if you start off with a conclusion, you know, you can write a pretty good story based on whatever plot you want to construct. You asked earlier, right before the end of the on-air segment, I think, you asked why would someone make a documentary like this? And this is a thing that skeptics as a sort of community of people tend to differentiate between two. There are people who are outright hucksters, right? They want to tell you about, you know, some conspiracy or some quack, you know, medical claim or whatever, because they want to sell you, you know, the magic beet juice that cures cancer, or buy my book on, you know, whatever it is that will make your immune system stronger, those sorts of things. That's one class of people, and they're usually pretty easy to identify. On the other hand, there are people who are just true believers, and, you know, they really are filled with conviction about what they're doing. They have a great passion for it, a kind of, you know, a obsession almost. I don't want to say that like it's a bad thing. Obsession is a great thing. But once you have that sort of, you know, I've staked out my position and I need to present this to the world, and I'm not looking at conflicting evidence anymore, because it's no longer about me figuring out the truth. It's about me telling people, quote unquote, the truth. Then they get locked into a sort of epistemic closure where any conflicting evidence that comes at them is an attack that they have to then defend against. And then the question that this is the, one of the things that you said is that you start off a lot of conversations with what is at stake for you emotionally in this. And that's a good question to ask. The corollary that I tend to use is I start off conversations with what is the evidence that you would have to see to convince you that you were wrong? Because, you know, I've made the mistake of getting involved with certain kinds of medical quacks and, you know, conspiracy theorists, and I'm just furiously like Googling things up and pulling up information from journals and linking into it. And then, you know, an hour and 45 minutes into the because I think we're having a conversation, an hour and 45 minutes into the exchange, you know, they say something like, well, you know, I don't trust the scientific method. And then you go, oh, okay, well, then we're not, you know, this isn't a conversation we're supposed to be having. You may as well just be, you know, holding up voodoo charms at me and okay, saying, you know, get thee behind me, Satan. So you have to ask people, like, what is the evidence that they would require for themselves to conclude, oh, this position is wrong? And that's the thing that a lot of people, skeptics and believers, can have a real problem with, because it creates cognitive dissonance.
Sure. And I think an important thing to point out is that you mentioned that there's hucksters and then there's people who are believers. And then in from the perspective of people who have processed what they see in the mainstream media as the final word on reality, then there would be us, you know, people who self-describe as libertarians, as a third type of conspiracy theorists. But they don't do the types, right? So I think it's important for us to try to approach these topics with as much humility and understanding and patience as possible, because when it comes to some of these people who might suggest these things that are more far out there, there's people who look at us the same way, and we know how that feels. But you're absolutely right. On the other hand, too, where I've had conversations with somebody who I'm not in love with labeling people, but what I would have described throughout most of my podcasting career as a statist, I get this suspicion maybe 5 minutes, maybe an hour, maybe 5 years into the conversation that they are just trying to escape with whatever their belief system is intact, right? And they're just going through the motions, as you describe, of having a conversation, but it's not really going anywhere because there's too much at stake to do the 180 or even maybe whatever reconsideration is necessary. So I think that's a good point. Anything else that you want to cover with us?
I do want to point out that of course, you know, a moon landing hoax is, you know, in theory completely plausible, at least as, you know, in terms of how one could pull it off. It certainly would have been a simpler way to, you know, achieve the same goal to actually doing it. But I would provide another alternative, you know, at least possible alternative narrative that I also think sort of makes sense, which is that by most accounts that I'm familiar with, the entire point of the moon landing, well, I shouldn't say the entire point. There were a lot of people wanting a lot of things, but, you know, certainly showing off the Soviet Union was a huge one. It certainly seems to me that an organization like a government would be perfectly comfortable spending, I have no idea what the initial budget for it was, but let's just say it was, you know, $10 million or, you know, $15 million, to do something that they could have done on a Los Angeles soundstage for $185.
Right.
If you have, for all intents and purposes, limitless resources at your disposal, then why not do something extraordinary? And, you know, it's a possible thing to do. Why not do it in a more wasteful way? And I use wasteful in air quotes because the moon landing is flipping awesome. I think it's great for science. I think it's great that it inspired a generation of kids to go become scientists. But certainly if that was the thing that you wanted to accomplish, was just to have a, pardon my French, dick waving contest with the Soviets, then yeah, doing it on a Los Angeles soundstage for $185 would have been a more sensible way to do it. It seems to me that it's at least as plausible a story that governments are just comfortable throwing millions and millions of dollars at doing something the hard way when it could have been done simply.
Yeah, I think that there's a variety of different ways to the story, and I don't want to frame this issue as either or, because I think it's more complicated than that. There's more than two things, like they did go or they didn't go. There's a lot more possibilities, and I think one of the things that Sam is going to bring up is that maybe the soundstage activity was a backup, because I said earlier in the show, it's not good in the midst of all of this, the space race, the arms race, everything that's at stake, it's not good to have Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins explode on TV. That's bad. And when you see all of the majesty and the amazement of 2001 A Space Odyssey, yeah, that's the guy you would want to do what you show on TV. That would make sense. But Alan, I'll let you go. Thank you so much for your input. It's always good to have you on the show, and we'll definitely have to do it again in the future.
Sounds good. Sounds like a plan, brother.
All right. Have a good night. Thanks again.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right, Sam. It's first of all, good to talk to you. It's been a while, and you are on, sir.
It has. Okay. Well, you know, first I just want to say I really appreciate the approach that you're taking and kind of the open-mindedness with that you're looking at this subject matter and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how I look at things. I go around finding people who have a story to tell, and I listen to what they have to say, and I kind of can we use government banned words?
You can say we're off LRN, so you can say whatever you want.
Okay. You know, I kind of get a feel for, is this person full of shit, or are they, you know, telling something that sounds pretty plausible, or are they backing up what they're saying with fact and evidence and so forth? And then I kind of fit it into what I've heard from other pieces to kind of create this story. And it's not that you guys were talking about, well, what would it take for you to change that belief? What if you were wrong about this? Well, I don't consider myself attached to any one truth, because when you're right about something, the possibility dies. And because you know it, you know this is the way it is, and you're right about it, so you don't really need to consider anything else. And I tend to kind of go through life looking at what's out there and evaluating it for myself, fitting it into what I see as, you know, what's probable. And when another piece of evidence comes along that maybe dislodges some others, I fit it in and throw away the other stuff that doesn't seem as credible anymore, if that makes sense.
Sure.
Okay. So I take it, Brett, that you watched The Shining Code and kind of thought, as I did, probably that some of the connections that they were making were a little ridiculous and maybe weren't so much there, but yet there were other ones that really, I think, hit home.
My assessment of the film was that somebody watched The Shining and they see this scene where the boy stands up on the rug, the exact same part that I heard you tell on Free Talk Live. And like I said, okay, I ran to YouTube after that call. I ran to YouTube because this is the thing that I want to believe. This is like the sexiest theory ever.
Okay.
The scene that you described, where he stands up on the octagonal pattern in the rug and he has the Apollo 11 shirt on and he walks to room 237 and he comes out and he's silent. I feel like somebody saw that. They recognized the symbolism there. In that part, it's pretty heavy, right? If he's got if the room number has changed.
That is the most blatant of the whole thing.
Yeah. Right. And he said, well, you know, I can't make a 3-minute documentary. So he went on a real Easter egg hunt for the other stuff that made up the other 55 minutes of the film, depending on which version. Like I said, it seemed like almost a parody of a conspiracy theory movie, that the connections were just so flimsy other than that. I think there is a lot to Kubrick. I think there is, like Alan said, you know, he's eccentric, but I am very interested in pursuing an investigation into, like, what is he embedding into his films and why? Because obviously it's something, right? The narrative, as you said, Corey, and I think you guys both said, Osborne, you said you weren't a huge fan of his movies, or one of you said that, right?
I don't understand them.
Okay, yeah. There's something
very confusing.
He's not giving the audience a straightforward narrative. In other words, you as a listener or a viewer of a Stanley Kubrick film have to be in a more active brain state than you would be to watch most other movies, especially in 2001. I watched it 12 or 13 times. I think it is a phenomenal movie. I don't know what it's about.
Yeah, it's not clear. But, you know, that whole thing where you, like, you know, you think, I think that's a very plausible theory that you have about the guy saw the scene with the kid with the Apollo 11 sweater and he stands up and it kind of looks like the rocket's taken off and then everything just grew from there. But sometimes things like that happen. Sometimes there's a weird synergy with things that you watch. Like you can watch, you can play Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon while you're watching The Wizard of Oz, and there's some really bizarre ways that the what they're singing about matches up with the action on screen, that but that doesn't make it intentional.
Oh, I used to watch 2001, and like this is when I was in college and I had a lot of free time and I also did a little pot. I would watch the scene from 2001 with the Jupiter, the Infinity and Beyond scene.
Right.
And I would go through my music collection and experiment to try and sync. Hmm. And it seemed like when you're high and you are excited about this project, just about everything that you can put in a CD player will sync with that scene in a pretty awesome way. What else is compelling for you, Sam, about it, I guess?
Yeah, let me give you... So I watched The Shining Code. I called the first time and talked about it, and then I went back and watched The Shining, the movie, and I actually found something in there that missed, and Brett, it, from earlier, it sounds like you're a big fan of Kubrick and know quite a bit about him, and I found something that I think might even convince you of to shift your opinion. And it's early on in the movie when they get checked in. I think it's 1 month later when everybody's gone, and Jack is sitting on the bed, okay, in their little apartment that the manager gave him to stay in, and Danny walks into the room. And the shot is of Danny kind of at the foot of the bed, Jack sitting on the bed in a bathrobe, and there's a little dressing table with a mirror. And in the mirror, you can see they lined it up so you can see Jack. And what they've done is they took a pair of pants and they folded it over the dressing table or the chair or whatever was there so that from the camera angle, if you looked at the image presented in the mirror, it looked like Jack was standing up wearing a pair of pants. And in the mirror, if you look over his head on the back wall, above the bed, there's this oval-shaped fish statue or little ornament, decorative piece, I guess. And then as soon as Danny walks over and sits down next to Jack, they do the reverse shot, and the little fish oval thing over the bed is gone. Now, if you know Stanley Kubrick and what a stickler for detail he was, and you know anything about how motion pictures are made, that's not an amateur mistake like Stanley Kubrick would make in the middle of his career. And B, you have a script supervisor who's looking for incongruencies between shots. And there's really no reason that they would take this thing off the wall.
So what this is called in filmmaking, and the average Hollywood film will have about 50 of these types of errors in there. And I do agree with what Sam's saying, that somebody like Kubrick and Scorsese was the same way, who once reshot a scene in Raging Bull because a guy in the third or fourth row had a watch on that was not made at the time when the Jake LaMotta was fighting Sugar Ray Robinson in the 40s. So, I agree with that. And these continuity errors are because what might appear to be 2 minutes on film needs to be shot over the course of several hours or even days. This is very detectable in a restaurant scene. If you want to experiment, when you see two people with food or cigarettes or
That's
drinks
right.
at a restaurant, put it at 8 times speed, and you should see a lot of the times their drinks will go boop, 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 up and down, up and down, yep, up and down.
Their cigarettes will be varying length.
Yeah, and it was actually Martin Scorsese who figured out a workaround for this in Casino, where Robert De Niro is smoking in every single scene. So he had him. You notice if you watch that movie that he's holding his cigarettes in an awkward way with his fingers, as you hold things usually, but he's holding them in a way where the cherry of the cigarette is always the same distance from the end of his fingers. So no matter how much of it is on the other side, in the continuity, it always looks the same because he's always holding it about an inch from the cherry of the cigarette, because he's just constantly smoking and cigarettes burn right very quickly. So, yeah it's a good point that Kubrick is incredibly meticulous. Jack Nicholson absolutely dreaded the experience of making that film, of shooting some scenes over 100 times for no reason that was ever explained to him. I mentioned earlier in the show tonight that I did watch the documentary about the making of The Shining that Vivian Kubrick made with a home camera, looking for clues in Kubrick's methodology, the way blocking was done, the way shots were set up, lighting, positioning. I didn't see anything that was suspicious, but what does that, the scene with the fish, Sam, what does that mean to you?
So I look at that and I think that Kubrick is telling us very early on in the film that what's being presented to you, meaning that what's being reflected in the mirror, is not necessarily reality. Because as soon as you turn around and get the reverse shot, he's not wearing pants. He's sitting on the bed in a bathrobe, and there's no fish thing over the bed. So he's letting you know that something's not right here. Things are not as they seem. Objects in the mirror may be closer than they appear.
Well, I mean, I understand that, but the movie is The Shining, and kind of a pretty consistent theme through that is shit's not right here. So
That's right.
It could have been, it could have been, I know all my examples are Scorsese when we're talking about Kubrick, but there's a foreshadowing scene in Goodfellas where the shit's not right here moment is, there's a shot where Ray Liotta and Robert De Niro are sitting at a table, and they do this shot where the camera is tracking forward. This is like where a camera's on a dolly, but instead of moving side to side, it's moving in and out. So the camera's dolly or tracking forward, but the zoom on the camera is being taken out. So they're zooming out while they're dollying forward. And you see that within the frame, the positioning of the actor stays the same, but the entire background, almost like you have vertigo, just entirely shifts. So I think that there's plenty of inventive ways to create a sense of discomfort or some kind of subconscious participation for the audience. I don't know if you've ever seen Rosemary's Baby. There's a scene where one of the weirdo olds is on the phone, but the shot is set up in a way where her face is just being blocked by a door jamb. And they said in the theater, when people saw this movie, that it looked like the shot had just been set up wrong, the camera was in the wrong place, that everybody in the theater like lunged to the side to try and like see around the door jamb because they want. So I think there's a variety of techniques that filmmakers will use to create audience participation or audience discomfort.
Mm.
Let me give you a couple more.
Okay.
Along those same lines. I mean, there's certainly the one that's pointed out in the Shire Code where they're driving up the coast in this yellow Volkswagen Beetle. And then when he gets into the hotel, the manager asks him, "Did you get your luggage in?" And he points over his shoulder to this pile of luggage that could not possibly fit in a Volkswagen Beetle if there were no passenger, nobody in it
yep.
to begin with.
Yep.
And so, you know, that's another one of those. But then also the scene where, you know, if you kind of walk through the movie, if you remember the part with the naked woman in the bathtub, that's when Jack goes into the moon room for the first time. And this is really, he goes in the bathroom, he sees this naked woman in there, she starts to get up and comes towards him, and he's like, "All right, here we go," and he's smiling. And that's showing him sort of falling in love with the idea of working with NASA and doing something really important. But then as it goes along, she turns out to be this rotten, decaying thing that he wants to get away from. And that's really the turning point in the whole movie. From there, that's when he goes crazy and becomes more disheveled and so forth. And when he's in the writing room after the wife sees that he's typed all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, there he's explaining to his wife what would happen. She wants to leave, and he's like, what, you think we can just leave? You think I can just not live up to my agreement? I have a contract with these people. If I leave now, I would be finished. I'll never be able to write again.
There's a scene where he says, do you know what would happen to me if I backed out of my obligations? If I didn't live up to my obligations, that
I would be finished, I think is another one of the quotes. And if you think about it, he's wanting to go back and be this writer. Why would a writer who quit a job as a hotel caretaker be finished and never be able to write again? In the context of the story, it doesn't make sense. In the context of, well, the hotel manager was NASA, and you know, this is all representative of him working to fake the Apollo 11 missions, it makes a lot of sense, because these are, you know, powerful people who have connections who could see that he never works again. And also, at the end, when the caretaker tells him, you know, your wife's very strong, you better take care of this or we're going to, I think he was kind of scared that, I don't know if he told her or, you know, what happened in their marriage, but it seems like that's another sort of slight hint that he was told, you better keep quiet about this. Also, the scene at the bar where the bartender says, no, your money's no good here. And he says, I like to know who's buying my drinks. And the bartender says, well, that's not for you to know right now. And so it's showing that he can have whatever he wants. That's where, why I think he got the camera lens or the spy satellite lens that you were talking about earlier, that he would get whatever he wants. But then the old caretaker that murdered his family takes him into the bathroom and warns him, you better shut your wife up or we're going to take care of it.
The other thing, so, too, is that just a general note about the whole idea would be that if this theory is true, the clues in the film would have to be so subtle, right? Because, Corey, you're nodding your head.
Yes.
Because the risk of exposing the story, if it were true, would be basically death.
Yes, so, and he tells us that he was roughed up because when Danny comes out of the room, he's got marks on his throat, his sweater's torn, and he won't talk about it.
Right.
He won't tell his mom what happened in that room, and they probably said, look, if you tell anybody about this, we're going to kill you.
So what?
And possibly your
and
family.
So that's the pressure that he was under, and that's what kind of sent him over the edge, I think.
I mean, what people would need to understand, and certainly this wouldn't prove anything either, how much are these scenes that stick out for people in the movie departures from Stephen King's book? What damage do these departures do to the actual story? In other words, they weren't careless mistakes or clumsy misinterpretations, that they were deliberate. And that was, again, why I watched the documentary, for the hopes of finding something that would suggest some kind of, you know, active plan to do something like this. But I don't think, either I didn't know enough or I didn't watch closely enough, but I didn't see anything like that.
So, well, there's the three main differences that I know, and that's the room was originally 217, not 237. The car that they were driving in was a red Volkswagen Beetle, not a yellow one. Yellow, you know, they're on the road driving to the sun in the background. Of course, the god of the sun is Apollo. I think there's some symbolism there that he's sort of embedding into the subconscious. And there's also another mistake and an inconsistency in the film, when he's interviewing with the manager in the office in the very beginning of the film, he tells him about the previous family. Now, you've heard about them. He had a wife and two daughters, I think 8 and 10. And in the book, they were two daughters. They were not twins, but in the movie, they were twins. And that's something that he changed. And what the Code movie suggests is that the twins represented Gemini, where the astronauts died. Gemini, of course, being the astrological sign that relates back to the twins. But the manager of the hotel refers to them as 8 and 10, which matches the novel, but everything else in the film shows them as being identical twins of exactly the same age. So that's another one that I don't think Kubrick would miss something like that.
Okay.
I mean, even if it was nothing but the Apollo sweater scene, you know, I'm intrigued. And like I said, I think some of my derision about the documentary was driven by disappointment. Because how cool would it be if, you know, if this was like ironclad?
Ironclad or at least interesting to watch.
Yeah, I felt like there was a lot of reaching, and I was just kind of generally disappointed because, like I said several times, I want to.
We're overlooking
this.
The most compelling piece of evidence in that, which actually came from the behind the scenes documentary filmed by his daughter.
Okay,
which is where we see Kubrick on set wearing a shirt that says "I helped fake the Apollo 11 moon landing, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt."
Is that real?
No. If I were Kubrick, I would wear something like that. If I were still alive, I would wear that in public just for laughs.
When I think about these,
think about it. Go ahead, Alex.
Okay. So when I think about these conspiracy theories, I try to put myself in the mind of whoever it was that was supposed to have done these things, and try to figure out what I would do. So if I'm Stanley Kubrick and I didn't fake the Apollo moon landing, the first thing I do is start dropping clues to people to make it seem like I did.
Why?
Because that would be fun and make me look cool. Like, I can remember, like,
why Apollo and why not some other event?
Well, clearly he was into the space thing, right? Like, he made the 2001 Space Odyssey movie. He worked with these NASA people. So he, in his mind, he's thinking, I can help perpetuate this plausible theory that I helped do this thing.
Well, and I would go the same sort of general direction that you, but I would take a different tact and think, okay, if I'm Stanley Kubrick and I did fake the moon landing and there are these people who have threatened my life, threatened my wife and so forth, and I wanted to sort of put I wanted to let people know through this film, what I would do is go through the script beforehand and plan out as much as I could of this stuff. And it makes sense as to why he would have, you know, some scene shot over and over again 100 times, because he spent probably weeks ahead of time thinking of all of these little clues and breadcrumbs that he's left throughout the movie, as well as scripting in some really more obvious ones and so forth.
Right. But
you know, things you're going to find when you get on set, others you can, I think, plan in. And I think it sort of suggests that that's what he did.
Sure. Oh, I mean, but he did that with all his movies. I mean, this is the guy who reshot the entire movie of Eyes Wide Shut for whatever reason was in his head. I don't know. So I agree with what you just said. And except for if I'm that Stanley Kubrick, I absolutely do not put that Apollo 11 shirt on that kid, because it's just way too glaringly obvious. If I'm trying to keep myself from getting killed.
Well, you know, there's also, when you get into, like, you guys were talking about 9/11 earlier, there's always seems to be, with these conspiracy theorists that suggest it's a false flag operation run by the elites or the powers that be or whatever, but there always seems to be clues that they drop, that they let you know, here's what we're going to do. And if Stanley Kubrick can do that under the radar in the way that he did, that's not so much of a threat to them. That's something that they typically would do anyway. Does that make sense?
I gotcha. Or at least might tolerate it. Be like, okay, go ahead, blow off steam, little man.
Because they know that that's going to go right under the radar of the average sheep. That it's going, and look at what happened to me when I got on Free Talk Live and suggested that people go look at the evidence. They called me, you know, idiot and a nut job and all of these things, and not one of them bothered to look at anything that I pointed out. You know, they just fell back on, oh, that sounds crazy. That conflicts with my belief system. I don't even have to look at it. You're an idiot.
And
that's what most people do.
And that's exactly why Kubrick wouldn't have been assassinated for doing it, if that is in fact what he was doing. Because they just know anybody who points out those coincidences is just going to look like a kook to most people.
Right. And they know they can rely on that because they're also, you know, there's the quote from the CIA director that I think it was from the 70s or 60s that they control or they have a relationship with every significant media personality. And this was Project Mockingbird, I believe, where they basically had every news person in their pocket in one way or another. So they controlled the media and they control the mind control, if you will, and the programming that is fed to the mass media. And what has it been all these years? Those 9/11 people are crazy. Those conspiracy theorists are crazy. So anybody who suggests even something remotely related to it, that's automatically the defense mechanism that they've programmed in to be triggered.
I think that that's a fallback that I feel like I've been a little bit too reliant upon on my show, making a lot of my arguments. And sometimes I think that I give up and say, oh, well, you know, it's just because you went to public school and you can't think and the media is controlled by elites. And if the goal is to convince people, obviously those are things that we could say that would cut off communication. And I would just be careful about those kind of fallbacks of, well, you know, the media is controlled by the CIA. And it's true. I mean, they had the church committee hearings and one of the congressmen asked the guy, does the CIA have people working at television? And he says, let's do that part in executive session. And then the next question is, does the CIA have people working at newspapers? Let's do that part in executive session. The answer is. The CIA have people working here, you know, and then so they won't.
Brett, I hear what you're saying, and I'm not saying that people can't break out of the programming, that it's got this grip on them that they're just completely unaware of. I'm saying that it's a numbers game, and that as long as they're keeping, say, 80-90% of the people thinking inside of the paradigm that they've created for them.
Yeah.
Then, you know, who cares if 10% of the chickens escape the farm, you know?
Okay. Right. Well, here's just so I can expound on my point, just to make sure that it's clear. From a rhetorical standpoint, it is very true. It is very real that there was a thing called MKUltra, these experiments that were done mainly with some of the scientists that had been pulled from Third Reich in the 50s, in the 60s, with drugs and torture and sleep deprivation and loud noises. And all these experiments were done on unwitting people, unwilling people. And the takeaway would be like, well, you know, you're mind controlled. And the reason is MKUltra. Well, MKUltra is a thing that happened. It's real. It's not even, that's not even conspiracy. But right. Did it work? You know, that's a whole other topic. Were these methods effective? Did they develop ways to control people? And so when you just say, well, MK Ultra happened, so now everybody is mind controlled by the government, is not and I'm not saying that you're doing this, Sam. I'm just giving an example of something that I don't think is rhetorically acceptable. MK Ultra does prove that the government was willing to invest time and resources and minds into experimenting with the ability to control the public mind. That is provable. So again, we're back to deductive, where we can make a general rule that the government has an interest in public relations, propaganda, and then we have numerous examples that can hold that general rule up.
So I say this as much to myself because I'm guilty of this in the past. We should just be cognizant of where we might be trying to take shortcuts, because we have these facts, this information that we want to get to people. And when they obfuscate and when they don't want to let it through, or they just say, oh, you're stupid, or you need to watch more MSNBC/Fox News and then you'll know how what's really going on. We get frustrated and we say, oh, you know, you're mind controlled. You're a sheep. You're a product of the government education system. And go ahead.
I see that a lot from sort of the Alex Jones mindset. When people don't agree with them, that's exactly what they do. And you're not going to convince anybody by you know, antagonizing them and calling them names.
Sure.
So I don't know if there's more that you want to cover here, or if you'd like to go back to maybe my thoughts on what actually may have happened with the moon landing, and you know, where do you want to go?
I'm interested in what your thoughts are and why on what this whole Apollo thing really was, because I find it fascinating, the topic in general. I have a strong, again, pointing out my own confirmation bias and my willingness tonight to fight it. I want to believe this. So,
So unlike any other conspiracy theory, I just love thinking about what's going on in the minds of these people as they're concocting this plan, and what, and if it's a fake thing, what they actually spent all that money on.
Okay.
So, it's just so weird to think that there was a time in this country where you would hide defense spending inside NASA's budget.
Yeah.
Like, it's so, like, it's exactly the opposite of what you might do now.
Yeah.
Except that they have no interest in funding NASA.
Or imagining what it'd be like if I were a little kid and that came on the TV. Like, would I be like I am now and just look at that and be like, oh, look at that fake thing?
All right, so go ahead, Sam. Well,
I hope you guys have your tinfoil hats ready, because we're about to go off the deep end here.
Nice.
Okay, folks listening to the podcast, at this point, I had to make an editorial decision. The conversation in the live show continued for another 20 or 25 minutes with Sam, and it was very interesting. But considering the purpose of this podcast, that extra time, I mean, I've already asked you to listen to more than 2 hours of show here. So that extra 20 or 25 minutes really didn't add anything that serves our purposes today. If you are interested in hearing the rest of this discussion, go to the show notes for this episode where I have embedded this video. I've used the embed settings in YouTube to hopefully have it queue up right where we left off. So I was very interested in what Sam had to say, but I thought I would give you, you know, the choice. And I was glad that we were able to give Sam the opportunity to elaborate on some of the stuff that he's been trying to bring up on Free Talk Live. Now, I think that it's very easy to be dismissive of new ideas, but instead of immediately dismissing something out of hand, I think an important first question to ask is about plausibility. And if something is plausible, then, you know, if you have time and the interest, it might warrant an investigation. I think we all know the feeling of being ridiculed and dismissed when trying to share new ideas with people. We know that that's really not the best feeling in the world, especially when a lot of us believe, a lot of us know that some of the stuff we have to share is very important. And of course, on the other hand, when you're on the receiving end of new information, seemingly unbelievable new information, I hope that these fallacies of omission, especially the loaded question, the argument from the negative, and stacking the deck, will assist you in making a real-time evaluation of whatever is being presented. And you can point these things out to the presenter, if possible, and then you can see what kind of a retreat might take place at that point. On a final note, if any of you are intrigued by this whole Kubrick directed the Apollo missions story, and you find some evidence that someday could lead to a definitive conclusion, of course, that says that he did it,
please let me know. We will make t-shirts. We will make documentaries. I will gleefully run to the hilltops and shout it for all to hear. Thank you for listening, and take care.
20 years later, and years behind schedule, the same space program couldn't put into Earth orbit a telescope with a lens that focused. And yet, 2 decades earlier, a mission 100 times more complicated worked on its first occasion. With close scrutiny of the motives of the zealous Nixon administration, a critical examination of the entirely government-controlled press coverage, and newly discovered footage of the crew of Apollo 11 staging part of their mission, we wish to detail what may come to be the greatest government conspiracy of all time. A funny thing happened on the way to the moon.
We all think we know the tale of Apollo 11's triumphant success, but behind this legend lies a very different story. The untold account of how close the mission came to tragedy. Now, nearly 40 years later, men on that famous adventure reveal what really happened on the first voyage to the moon. We discover how the lunar module lost all contact with Earth and was almost out of fuel, heading for a boulder-filled crater. How astronauts believe they encountered a UFO in deep space, an event covered up until now. Classified documents show how President Nixon prepared an emergency speech when fears grew that the crew would get stranded. And we reveal how ultimately the crew only returned alive thanks to a ballpoint pen. This is the true, untold story of Apollo 11's mission to the moon.
Stop on Apollo 11.
For all the success and spin put on the Apollo moon missions in the late 1960s, NASA has never fully answered the question, why have they never returned to the moon? Some ex-NASA employees know the answer, and that is that the moon is crawling with aliens.
What's beneath the stars? The universe was ours. Love was all we knew, and all I knew was you. I wonder if you know. I wonder if you think about it. Once upon a time in your wildest dream,
you subscribe to geography trivia. You just say a person's name.
All right, everyone, welcome back to this thing. First, today we have Gideon, who is in Perth, Australia. Let me tell you this, when I looked this city up, the pictures that came back, this city's skyline is breathtaking. Heath Ledger came from Perth, and Perth also became known as the City of Light because so many of the residents decided to flip on their house lights and street lights as the astronaut, John Glenn, this is fitting for today, passed overhead while orbiting the Earth in Friendship 7 in 1962. And then they did the same thing when Glenn was on the space shuttle in 1998. City of Light, neat story. Next, we have Mike in Haywards Heath in the United Kingdom. This is the home of the United Kingdom's National Cat Adoption Center. That's right. The name speaks for itself. So let's hear what some people on TripAdvisor.com had to say. One user writes, try to leave without adopting a cat. Very hard. Went to an event there which was well organized and fun, despite the horrendous weather. A good place to visit at any time. Teas, etc. Very helpful staff. Another listener writes, perfect for families. My daughter chose this as a place she would like to visit from an attraction leaflet. It is free to visit. There are 3 wings and you can move freely between them. The staff are super nice and very approachable. Even my normally shy daughter managed to ask if she could open one of the doors to let her stroke 2 cats. Cameron in Shelby Township, Michigan. Shelby Township is the home of John Mazza, one of the winningest professional bowlers ever, an 8-time titleist in the PBA, Professional Bowlers Association. He's still alive, too, so you might be able to spot him getting a custard at Custard Spot on Van Dyke Avenue. Next, we have Blake, who actually recently upgraded his membership. He's in Medford, Oregon. Now, this one is interesting. There is actually a reference to Medford in Billy Wilder's 1944, I think, film noir, Double Indemnity. When one of the characters, Mr. Jackson, played by Porter Hall, is being investigated about the death of another character, and he says to the investigator, "Mr. Keys, I'm a Medford man, Medford, Oregon. Up in Medford, we take our time making up our minds. See?" I don't know if he talked like that. I don't remember. Jeff L., who is in Charleston, West Virginia. Charleston, West Virginia, first brick road in the world, 1870 on Summers Street. Have you ever seen a brick road? Breathtaking. Beautiful. It's like the Perth, Australia skyline, if it was a road. Then we have Jeff H., not too far away from me, in Merrimack, New Hampshire. Interesting story. I had to go all the way to the Los Angeles Times to get a fact about Merrimack, New Hampshire. 1996, right after I finished high school, I found this article. School district anti-gay policy splits New Hampshire town. Classroom references to homosexual issues and AIDS are banned in Merrimack, pitting neighbor against neighbor. Foes file freedom of speech lawsuit in federal court. It says the school board's conservative majority is standing firm, insisting that the policy protects children. Hundreds of students, however, are wearing black armbands or pink triangle pins in protest. Meanwhile, teachers have altered how they teach classics such as Moby Dick, Of Mice and Men, A Raisin in the Sun, The Glass Menagerie, and William Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, and As You Like It, to avoid any discussion of homosexuality, either in plot or authorship. This was later pulled, this policy. They called it the Prohibition of Alternative Lifestyle Instruction. And finally, today we have Robert, who is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. It was in Minneapolis that the McGraw Electric Company in 1926 first marketed the pop-up toaster. It had a retail price of $13.50 or $172 in today's money. That might sound expensive, but, toast.
New subscriber, geography, trivia, you just say a person's name, and they tell a fact about where they live. Chicka-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba.